This is a book really about love life, and a lot of it is about, well, the main focus of it is Micheál's wife, Breege, who he has been married to for 35 years. And it's an extraordinary book in the terms of it's not just about the falling in love stage, but it's also about those 35 years, about long-term love. And Micheál will be reading some of that to us as he comes in. Now, a few more things about Micheál, about his career. I got to know him first, actually, before he got to know Breege. I got to know him 39 years ago, I worked out this morning. We were both students in Trinity College Dublin, and I attended one of his free Irish learning classes. He was teaching Irish to people. That's just what we need. We became friends then, and he went on to become, first of all, a lecturer in Celtic Studies in Trinity College Dublin, then a professor in the Institute of Advanced Studies there, and in 1987 he did something that really I was just in awe of, I remember at the time, and still am. He went full-time as a writer. He started to live by his writing, by his poetry and poetry readings and so forth. And so since 1987, he has been writing he's been a full-time poet. Now, there'll be more. This is the first of two sessions. Here at 8:30 tomorrow evening, on Sunday evening, we will be having another session, which will be a bit more autobiographical. It'll be going deeper into poetry and into particular things in each other's poetry, more conversational, and also there'll be more time to interact with you than there's likely to be in this session. But that's the second part of this. But what we're doing this morning is that, first of all, we are plunging into poetry, and Micheál is going to read poetry and give an introduction to some of his poems from various books, but especially from the new book, Love Life. And then I'm going to plunge into theology, and then I hope there'll be a little bit of time for some feedback at the end. So, Micheál, over to you.
Can you all hear me? Good, thank you. I'm going to begin by letting you into a secret. I didn't dare tell anybody in Ireland that I was coming to Cheltenham to read poetry. Yes. For some strange reason in Ireland, they associate racecourses with horses. First of all, it's a wonderful privilege to be here to take part in Greenbelt, but it's also a great privilege to share this with David Ford. Not only do I know him for 39 years, but he is one of the finest people I know, and I've had the great privilege of having him write about my poetry in a wonderful book called The Shape of Living, some of you may know, and if you don't, I recommend it to you heartily. I'm afraid, of all his books, it's one of my favourites, because I'm utterly biased. As I came yesterday, I flew in from Dublin, and I had to wait. My plane was delayed. I had to wait quite a while at the airport. And though many people complain about airports, saying that they're always the same culture, no matter where you go, a sort of bland Coca-Cola airport culture. I, in fact, love airports, and the reason I love it is I love to see the way people take leave of one another. I love the way they greet one another. There's something about the whole process of watching people meeting and greeting in that way that has an intensity about it, which I would like to be the way in which I could live throughout my whole life with that intensity. I could love life. So I'm going to begin with a poem called Transit. Transit. Urgencies of language. Check in, stand by, take off. Everything a pace, businesslike, But I'm happy here, gazing at all the meetings and farewells. I love to see those strangers' faces quickened and bare. A lost arrival is wandering. A moment on edge, he pans a lounge for his countersign of welcome. A flash of greeting. Sudden lightning of baggage, as though he journeyed out only to journey home. I watch a parting couple in their embrace and freeing. The woman turns, a Veronica with her handkerchief, absorbing into herself a last stain of countenance. She dissolves in crowds. A Nora of her leaving glance travels through the yearning air. Tell me, we live for those faces, wiped into the folds of our being. I should have perhaps mentioned that the Veronica in that poem, for somebody with a Catholic background, it's obviously one of the stations of the cross, or indeed for a high Anglican background, it's that wonderful medieval story of the woman who, on the way to Golgotha, went out and wiped Christ's face with a cloth, and the image of Christ stayed on the cloth afterwards, and it became known, it's a medieval legend, it became known as the ver icon, the true icon. David mentioned this book, Love Life, which has just barely come out, so to speak. Well, I should say that a lot of poets I've known have written the most extraordinary elegies for their wives. I, in fact, had an older friend who I once heard say to his wife, "When one of us dies, I'm going to build a house in Tipperary." I'm afraid, rather than wait to write elegies, or worse again, as you've probably guessed, he was the first to go and not to be around to write anything, I wrote a book to try and give gratitude for 35 years of a glorious relationship. I want to start with one from the first phase of the book, which is that extraordinary moment of that period of falling in love. Is there anything really in the world that leaves us so exhilarated, leaves us that high of highs where our whole body seems to ooze with delight on that first phase of falling in love, which, of course, the author of the Song of Songs must have known about? Long song. Fragrance of your oils, l'amour fou, such sweet folly, your haunting presence, distilled traces of perfume, resonance of voice dwell in my nervous body. My skin wants to glow, all of my being glistens, divine shining through. Your lips like a crimson thread, your mouth is lovely, you're all beautiful, my love. Honeyed obsession of unreasonable love. Pleased, being pleased, I caress this amplitude, eternal roundness, voluptuous golden ring. Sap and juices sing Eden's long song in the veins. Spirit into flesh, the flesh into spirit. A garden fountain, a well of living water, flowing streams from Lebanon. Thank you. Wonderful in all is that first exhilaration, that first phase of falling in love is. There's always a danger, I think, of it becoming a two-ness, an isolated two-ness, in a way which becomes a sort of closing up or a shutting off, so to speak. The suffering outsider always seems to hover about, even about two lovers. Intrusion. The glaze of loved and lover. Our amorous self-containment, concentric and utterly present to the other. sweetest hour. But what if between our gazes shadows of the stricken fall, the stairs we seem to veil keep on commanding us? Our Tunis is never alone. Whose is that intrusive face that looms unseen between us, condemning all we haven't done? The eclipsed, the destitute, O sly worm of dominance, coiling its own discountenance, our masks and blotting outs. Is love a threadbare blindfold? Yes, say our shadows, unless you turn to face the faceless, who'll re-envisage the world. I've always had this deep sense that the voices and cries of all the outsiders of history still somehow are crying out to us. I think it's only by hearing these cries and voices can we, in some ways, adapt tradition, that we can be wise enough to change and, in fact, come to a stage where we don't think of our own victimhood, but rather concentrate and reserve that word for others. Crying out. Griefs written in wounded memory's song wind across our centuries, saying no to any easiness of why the world is wrong. Irreversible lines of ordeals once born in sudden flattened notes, a long, slow, uncoiling strain of losses we need to mourn. Don't look for me where streams are playing. In sweatshops klezmer, a shet stettles long ago, no soft peddling such musics of belonging. This knowing in the marrow how crops can fail. Fair hills of Erin, Bon, Chric, Erin, O, some coffin ship is busy setting its sail. There, behind the jazz, a soul is keening. No heaven on earth, Lord, nowhere I go, holding open all our agonies of meaning. The long, mute pleas of the dead, for us to remember things so beyond our ken, we hardly control our deepest urge to shun in dread their clammy-handed nobblings, to flee the ghostly buttonhole of those whose testimony shocks too much for us to hear, of patterns we're destined to rehearse. Unless a patient listening unblocks such clogged up fear of our histories, ancient mariners, voyages we need to face and word, stories of dreams stillborn, tragedies that never found a voice, cries of agony yet to be heard. So much we must mourn until our broken bones rejoice. A history of our world unravels into histories. The crying out of our once forgotten stories. The mended reed of voices we've refound, proclaiming that all that was trampled underground, but out of darkest silences now instead, we risk becoming everything we dread. The fractured clamor of each remembering victim, as deaf to the world as the world was deaf to them. Too many memories, and how our psyche smothers. Will our victimhood learn to keep this word for others? Apart from natural disasters and all the troubles of the world, of course, we have a history in Europe of our own inflicted troubles. Some years ago, I did a book to try and distill the experience of the Holocaust. And I just want to read one poem on it. And I do it. I chose this poem particularly because it's a love poem based in one of the camps in Auschwitz, in fact, because it is the intrusion, if you like. It is the one set off against the other love poems which I read. And when we think about what that destruction did, of course, it was to change. It's to take away the chance to love life and to live love lives in the fullest sense of that word. The poem is called Lily. Lab women and men in SS gardens consort. Lily is engaged to a pole in an undercover courtship. Her striped dress tight and short. Lily is 20 and styles herself for her lover. Never face on. Their whispered rendezvous. Cigarettes from a ration. Cucumbers he thieves. Small forbidden gifts. And their billet doux hidden for pickup under a pumpkin's leaves. Her fiancé sent to another commando. His friend fetches a note and is nabbed. A coded complot in sweet nothings. Prepared to take the rap, he's beaten but refuses to tell until in the end the Pole owns up to save him. All three are shot. We are, she'd written, like plants so full of sap. I always, and certainly after spending time with the Shoah, with the Holocaust, became to believe that the only way to avoid such evil happening again in our world is to somehow embrace the fullness, the richness, the whole jazz of life, and somehow to celebrate that and to travel in a trust. I think it's the only way that we can stave off the possibilities of such ideological dead ends. So a poem called March On. Always this urge to begin and re-begin. Armstrong's trumpet swings and skips. Oh, when the saints go marching in. As if rhythms keep needing to recompose this determined joy of passionate blues. His melody shatters the stricter tempos. He can't imagine it, and still he must. A garden where beginnings and ends collide. Every image is trying to widen our trust. Valhalla's vivid and endless carouse, blacks downing burdens by the riverside, promises of a father's many-mansioned house. For me, just my friends. Oh, jazz eternal, give me their warmth, the talk, the glory in faces of saints, boisterous and carnal. Oh, I want to be in that number when, his trumpet ransacking the melody's secret, Satchmo of the horn, march on, march on. One of the things that has always fascinated me in terms of music is how that after the Enlightenment and in some of the worst phases of colonial expansion, romantic music had a melody that dominated. In other words, before that we'd had polyphony and all the possibilities of voices being, that beautiful music we know from Bach, where you have all the voices being intertwined. But suddenly, in that phase, you had this domineering melody with everything else simply under it as a chord. So I use that image partly to face the whole business of postmodernism and the divide up, how the worlds have been reintroduced. We are allowed to have all these voices, And yet there's something that goes through like a thread through the polyphony that holds it all together. The poem is called Motet. Oh, my white-burdened Europe, across so many maps, greed zigzags. One voice and the nightmare of a dominant chord. Defenses, self-mirroring, echoings, myriad overtones of shame. Never again, one voice. Out of malaise, out of need, our vision cries. Turmoil of change, our slow renaissance. All things share one breath. We listen, clash and resolve, webs and layers of voices, and which voice dominates, or is it chaos? My doubting earthling, tiny among the planets, does a lover of one voice hear more or less? Infinities of space and time, melody fragments, a music of compassion, noise of enchantment, among the inner parts, something open, something wild, a long rumor of wisdom, keeps winding into each tune. Cantus firmus, fierce vigil of contingency, love's congruence. I'm going to finish off with a return to love poetry, to love life, and I want to read a poem which comes from the final section, which is one of the most extraordinary things if you've spent your life with another and grown with another human being, is facing up to the fact that one in the end has to be alone in most circumstances. I also want to capture in this more, as I go through the book, as David had mentioned, the subtle difference between falling in love and being in love. That amazing process of which comes with commitment and time. That slow sort of growing together. And even to the point of wondering often what it might have been like if it hadn't happened that way. This poem has, I try to combine in it, two of the great classic modes of the world. It alternates between sonnets and haikus. In other words, one of the great classic forms of the West alternating with one of the great classic forms of the East. And just one other comment before I read it, and that is that isn't it quite extraordinary? I mean, I'm sure many of you have thought of it before, but isn't it extraordinary how so many trees, and I think particularly of the sumac, which is one of my great favorites, reserve their most beautiful hues until the end. It's almost as though at the end of a love life, we come to love life most. Crimson thread. My love along the slopes of Gilead. This is our Eden before the bitter apricot. How unimaginable now our story if we had never met, never shaped each other's plot. Fracture and hurt of a once bruised youth, sores healed by wine and oil and spice. Kiss of life. Shulamites mouth to mouth. My wounds bound up in second paradise. Over and over, season by season by season, I'm older than my mother's crimson moment. Our slow-grown plot of risks and pardon as father cries how things would have been different if things were again. Oh, heart's secret treason, my sister, my bride, I come to your garden. again from under scarlet cords of winter fruit, a shumac burgeons. We roved out in all our youth and prime, both real and unreal, it seems somehow like reading a novel for the second time, to recall our unfolding in the light of now. So much that fell almost as if by accident, twists and corners we couldn't see or gauge. The plot gradually entangled as we went, that will have been our story, page by page. Two so close, two so utterly different. Clash and blur become a rich repair. Secrets held to love more open-eyed, lives sweet against the crimson moment. Chalk, our cheese of what we are, our share, lived in paradox of decades side by side. Deep, deeper yellow prepares a crimson moment, a Schumach's leaf falls. Jew, spice, honey, wine and milk, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, wear again for me the damson silk I take as given and still begin afresh. Awake, O north wind, come, south wind, never enough just to have rubbed along. Promise of promises nothing can rescind. All are nothing. All is Solomon's song. I come to my garden, my sister, my bride. Eat, friend, drink, and be drunk with love. And every moment I think I'm satisfied wakes me to desires I'm dreaming of. In Solomon's blue curtain, a cord of covenant, a crimson thread until the crimson moment. Thank you for listening.
It is worth saying that even as we have this session, Breed, Micheál's wife, is actually quite ill in a Dublin hospital, that yesterday he spent 3 hours with her before coming over here, but she absolutely insisted that he come here. So do please remember Breed. One of the poems that Micheál read was Lily, that one about the love affair in Auschwitz. And when I first heard Micheál read from that book, The Gossamer Wall, poems in witness to the Holocaust, it was in Oxford at a conference called Remembering for the Future. And that was a conference, a remarkable conference, that gathered together academics in a whole range of disciplines who have studied genocides of various sorts, and especially the Holocaust, the Shoah. Also artists, musicians, visual artists, poets, etc., novelists who gathered there, and also survivors of the Holocaust. And one of the most powerful moments was when Micheál had read some sonnets, not actually that one, Lily, but some other of the central section of sonnets about Auschwitz. One of the survivors came up to him afterwards and said that rang true, which must be the ultimate testimony to the giving of a testimony of that sort. And that note of testimony, it seems to me, I mean, we're trying to just say a little bit about the deep interconnection of poetry and theology now and tomorrow evening. And I think that note of testimony, too, is absolutely at the heart of good theology. But testimony isn't enough. When you are giving testimony to God, to the purposes of God, to the deepest connections that you can make between God and ourselves, between people and so forth, when you're trying to do theology like that, the further dimension always is, and of course it's there in poetry too, is to discern how that is involved in the shaping of life now and for the future. And I think that combination of testimony and discernment of the deep connections in life, that's what I would call theological wisdom, the search for a theological wisdom, things that go deeper and deeper into the core testimonies, and also deeper and deeper into contemporary life and the things that we live by and live for. And what does one say about wisdom? I think the first thing is that wisdom is to be desired. One of the things I love about Miho's poetry is the way in which, in so many moods, it gets the dynamics of desire at the heart of life. And in the Book of Proverbs, it's a book that's full of good common sense, but as you know, there's a passion behind it as well. Wisdom cries out in the street. You heard Miho's poetry about crying, a poem about crying out, that sense of getting deeper into the cries of history and of life now. Wisdom cries out in the street. In the square, she raises her voice. There's an urgency about it. And then a little bit later, happy are those who find wisdom and those who get understanding. For her income is better than silver and her revenue better than gold. She is more precious than jewels. And nothing you desire can compare with her. Nothing you desire can compare with wisdom. If you just think of what your desires are, and then you say that wisdom is incomparable in relation to any of our desires. All the desires, and we are in a world where desires, the manipulation of desire, the eliciting of your desires in different directions. I just look at my teenagers. I've got two teenagers here in this camp. And you just look at the way in which they are solicited from all quarters. Their desires are being aroused in all directions in order to give their time, their attention, their money to different things. We live in a culture where the most educated people, the best graduates of my own university, Cambridge, go into advertising. They're paid best there. And what are they doing there? They're trying to shape the desires of our culture. Now, what can we say in the face of all that? If nothing that we can desire can compare with wisdom, how do we get that? Just two points about it, first of all. First of all, that according to Proverbs and the whole of the Bible, wisdom is from God, fundamentally. God is the one who we are above all to desire. And God is utterly, utterly generous in giving wisdom. God wants us to have abundant wisdom. He actually desires that we seek wisdom. Hence the passion in Proverbs appeal to us. Seek wisdom. Get up early and find her. Do everything you can, more important than your income, more important than jewels, more important than everything else. She's your closest friend. She's your sister. She's the images for wisdom. Just run through the Book of Proverbs and all the other wisdom books. Some of the apocryphal wisdom books, like Sirach and the Wisdom of Solomon, are even more wonderful than that. They really go to town on these things. Now, in other words, there is wisdom to be found. Therefore, what we need is to have that passion for it, to make it utterly central in our lives so that our desire for wisdom is practically incomparable, that there is nothing else that we are seeking more importantly than wisdom. And we are promised that it comes to us. And the abundance of meaning in life that God is God. There is wisdom. God is a God of wisdom. God is a God of meaning. And there is always more. That's why poetry, it seems to me, is exactly the right sort of medium. Poetry, good poetry, you never come to the end of. You can take one of these sonnets and meditate on it. The next time you read it, it's different. The next time you read it, there's more and more and more. And it's that abundance of wisdom that is there, of course, in the Bible as well. That's the first point, that God is the God of wisdom, and it's there in abundance, and we are to shape our whole lives with a passion for this wisdom. The second thing is those cries that Michal said, his poem Crying Out, and wisdom cries out. We live, as I say, in a world where we are surrounded by cries, passionate cries. Greenbelt is just full of people crying out to us in different ways, sometimes in very, very loud music, quite late at night. And if you look at politics, what is politics about? Every government department, defence and the Home Office are about the cry for security. Trade and industry, the cry for prosperity and food and drink. Education, the cry for knowledge, and so on. That politics is about the wisdom of discerning how you handle all the cries. But each of our individual lives, each church's life, is also, there are cries that come of us from all sides. And what wisdom is about is a discernment of cries. How do we respond appropriately to them? How do we shape our life in the face of all these cries? And all of us have internal cries that go up inside us, the different passions, the different tugs in our lives that we're trying to shape, that we're trying to relate to as we go on. Now, how do we do all that? Now, when we begin to let this desire for wisdom loose in our life, the Bible is absolutely right in saying that it is the most exciting, fascinating, and worthwhile journey you could possibly do. Nothing is more fulfilling than the seeking of wisdom in our lives. But we need, in relation to that also, we need what I think might be called a wise faith. Now, our culture, our world is full of appeals to faith and appeals to desire, full of foolish faith. It's a big industry, foolish faith. What do you really trust? Millions and millions are to be made out of cultivating people's trust, cultivating people's faith. Now, I don't want to go on the negative for a long time, but I just want to say one point in relation to Christianity, and it goes for other areas too, obviously, but I particularly want to talk about Christian faith. And it's about the dangers of neat packages of faith. One of the ways in which people get gripped by faith is by being given a very neat package. This is what is so, full stop. This is what you do, full stop. A wonderful neat package. And because we yearn for the security of something to trust, we say yes, 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 and shut our ears, shut our eyes, shut our minds to all sorts of other things. Now, I just want to say as emphatically as possible that life is not a neat package. The Bible is not a neat package. Jesus Christ and the Holy Spirit are not a neat package. The Spirit blows around in all sorts of directions. And it's wild. It's wild. And therefore, you cannot have that neat package. Greenbelt is not neat. Life is perhaps, as I'm speaking from experience this morning, life is much more like waking up in a tent and than waking up in a 5-star hotel and having it all laid on. So there is not that neat. And the Bible, above all, the more I go on as a theologian, the more I just am amazed by the richness of the Bible. It's got wonderful simplicity in it, and you can go to it and just find something staring at your face, and wonderful simplicity, but it's also got complexity. And those people who try to wrap up the Bible in a safe package, in a neat package, and say, I have the answer, and these are the bounds, be very, very wary. Wise faith is a faith that is actually open to all the questions, is open to the glory of God's creation, is open to the wildness of the Spirit, is open in all sorts of directions, stretches your mind and your heart, your imagination and your will in all sorts of different directions, and deals with the real, messy, non-neat world. That's what we're involved in, and that's what, it seems to me, Greenbelt is very much against too. It's my first time here, but it's an absolute delight to be here and see the sort of spirit of this place. Now, just take the book of Job as one of the really great wisdom books. The book of Job about this good man who is tested to the uttermost. Most of the book, apart from the first chapter and the last chapter, is poetry. And that's worth remembering because it's not packaged. But what happens to Job? When he's tested to the uttermost, he responds by crying out. Just read chapter 3 for a most passionate, anguished cry, one of the most terrible cries that you could ever see in poetry, that he cries out. What do his friends do? They bring him packages. They say, look, we've got the answer for you. Here you are. Why don't you see that you've done something wrong and therefore God's punishing you? You know, that this is it. Everything makes sense. We've got it all wrapped up. And they're quoting their scriptures, actually. You know, they're quoting wisdom literature. They're actually quoting his Bible at him, so to speak. And they're saying, we have the answers for you. Job does not accept that. He cries out. He questions. He experiments. He thinks in all sorts of different directions. And above all, he desires God. He says, look, I know my Redeemer lives. I know that God is there. And this doesn't make sense. And I want to go through till I actually meet with God, till I grapple with God. And he does. That's what the book of Job is about. It's about this extraordinary drama of Job in the face of his friends' neat packages and answers to things, saying, no, the questions are more fundamental than your answers. They open out in different directions. And what happens? At the end, the verdict is that Job did right. God's verdict is that Job did right and his friends did not. In other words, the sort of wise faith that the book of Job encourages us to have is a faith that is in the midst of real life, that cries out, that isn't afraid to cry out in the face of the things that go wrong as well as the things that go right. There are cries of suffering and cries of joy. That we are in the midst of that, and wise faith resonates with the cries. If our faith does not resonate with the cry of Jesus from the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Then we do not have a faith that has gone to the heart of Christian wisdom, which is the wisdom of the cross. And The faith of Job is one, therefore, that goes through all those areas. Of course, there are things that you can say, yes, this is so. There are affirmatives in wise faith. Of course, there are imperatives. You must do this. These are things to be done. But embracing those affirmatives and imperatives is the constant need to question, because we do not have the whole truth until we see God face to face. Now we see through a glass darkly, then face to face. Questioning has always to be a part of faith. And experimenting, surprises, being open to the surprises that you can get around a place like this, that also is part of wise faith. And above all, desire, never letting our desire for God and God's wisdom go. That is what has to animate us day by day, week by week, year by year. And Job, therefore, is someone who, to reread that book, or read it if you haven't read it yet, is to find an antidote to many of the easy forms of faith, the forms of non-adult faith that we find around us in our culture, and that people will want to sell to you and make sure that you stay within those very strict bounds. Faith has to be as wide as God and God's whole universe. That is the scope of faith. Now, how do we find this wise faith? I just want to mention four sensible things. It's very unwise to ignore the experience of thousands and thousands, millions and millions of people who have gone these ways before. You know, we're not the first ones to be to be here. And therefore, it's always wise to try to learn the most obvious things. Don't ignore the elephant on the table. You know, look take the obvious things about faith and do them. Simply do them. Follow them. You know, try them out for 10 years or so before you give up on them. The first one is to worship, to be part of a worshiping community. Don't think you can do it by yourself. You know, I heard about somebody talking about somebody. It was a theologian who is a brilliant theologian, but who it was a fellow theologian who was telling me this. But who he says, you know, he won't belong to any church because none is good enough for him. You know, these boring places, you know, where they just worship. You know, look, whatever you feel about church, stick with it. Stick with church, whatever you do, because there is a deep, deep wisdom. It's like sticking with your family, you know, that it may be awful, it may be boring, there may be rows, and you may be very fed up with it in all sorts of ways, but you won't usually find anything better around. Take that with a grain of salt. Anyhow, the first thing you have to do is to worship, be part of a worshiping community, whatever it is, and be faithful to that year after year. As I say, try it for 10 years or so. The second thing is seek out wise Christians. You need accompaniment in your faith, and you need one-to-one accompaniment and small group accompaniment, as well as the larger congregation. Don't give up on either of those. There are an immense number of wise Christians around, actually. They're often a bit hidden, and you need to sort of get into the network and find out who they are. But we need accompaniment. You know, there's all sorts of things about spiritual directors and accompaniment and spiritual guidance and so forth. And that's quite rightly a growth industry at the moment, because in a sort of very rather fragmented individualist culture such as we have, you know, there aren't the sort of stable communities often, you know, and people move around all the time. And you need these networks. It's much easier to keep in touch with a spiritual director by email, actually, than it ever was before. But this sense that you actually need accompaniment, you need that those wise soul friends, those wise friendships to accompany you, it seems to me is pretty fundamental. That's the second thing. The third thing I've already talked about, be wary of those neat packages. Keep alive your mind, your heart, your imagination in relation to the real God, not the God of some little sect who say, we have God wrapped up. Go for the real God every time and be open to all the surprises and to the stretching of your mind and your heart and your life, your vocation and so forth in relation to that. Go for that. And the fourth one is, I would say this as a theologian, but read and reread the Bible. That, again, I mean, there is just so much there. And so much of it, of course, is poetry as well. You need to learn how to read poetry in order to read the Bible. But just read and reread. Read it in groups. Read it alone. Read it, you know, read it with commentaries. Read it and so forth. And it seems to me that one just never comes to the end of that. And it's wonderful to see things like Lectio Divina here at Greenbelt and all sorts of other ways of encountering the Bible. But I just want now to talk about the heart of wise Christian faith. Which is, of course, Jesus Christ. It's interesting that in Luke's Gospel, he twice says about the young Jesus Christ that he grew in wisdom. And later on, he is greater than Solomon, the great wise person. Jesus himself as a figure of wisdom. The Gospels, it's interesting, isn't it, to come back to the packages, that the way the New Testament presents Jesus Christ is not in one package. It's in four Gospels and all sorts of epistles as well. But those four Gospels are very different. And, of course, the really different one in relation to the others is John's Gospel. And I just want to say a little bit in conclusion about John's Gospel. And I want to take one wise person as my guide in relation to John's Gospel. One of the delights yesterday was going into the tent where the books are and seeing one of the first stalls I came upon was the stall of L'Arche, the L'Arche communities. Now, Jean Vanier is the founder of the L'Arche communities. There are about 100 of them worldwide now, and they are homes for people with various learning difficulties, disabilities, and assistance. And they live together. And one of the striking things about any L'Arche community, those of you who know them, is that at the heart of the ethos of L'Arche is the ethos of friendship, these surprising friendships, that assistants come, you know, young people often on a just taking a gap year or something like that, and they get involved with people with learning, often very severe learning difficulties and disabilities, and find to their surprise that what happens between them is actually a friendship, a deeply transformative friendship, something that goes both ways. But the whole community is built around this sense that those with disabilities are to be waited upon and so forth. And what Jean Vanier has done is he has written his most recent book out of 50 years of involvement is this book, Drawn into the Mystery of Jesus Through the Gospel of John. And I simply want, in conclusion, to recommend that you... That you try to get hold of that at some point. I'm not sure it is here on the bookstall. But the very core of that book is the concept of friendship with Jesus. And that is the inspiration of the friendship that's at the heart of the L'Arche communities. There is foot washing. There's their ceremony, their ritual in L'Arche is the foot washing, which is about service and so forth. There is also, of course, that sense of laying down your life for others. But at the heart of Vanier's treatment of John's gospel and of love is this wisdom of love that is about the deepest union with Jesus, with God, and with each other in terms of friendship. Jesus said, I no longer call you servants, I call you my friends. And that really is my final word in relation to Christian wisdom. That Christian wisdom, and it links up, I mean, Jean Vanier has some wonderful stuff about the Song of Songs at the end of his book on his commentary on John's Gospel. And Micheál, of course, takes the Song of Songs too as a climactic statement of what love is about. And that is, it seems to me, the heart of all of our wisdom. If we fail on this one, we've failed in everything, really, that it is the wisdom of love.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Unfortunately, we don't have time for questions as we have a back-to-back schedule today. Yes, indeed.
Might I say that we have slotted in a good deal of time for conversation. Tomorrow, 8:30 here, is the second session. And that was when we had decided, you know, the most interaction. So if you do want to respond to this session too, do come tomorrow evening at 8:30 here.
Thank you very much. The Emporium is open, so if you can exit both ways, that will help us clear the venue. Thank you very much.